coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Tuesday's general election sends Donald Trump back to the White House while Delaware remains solidly blue.
If you look at the figures that I've seen so far, it's been a pretty national shift towards Trump compared to the 2020 outcome. In Delaware, not enough to change the outcome, but still noticeable.
We get analysis on how the election played out from the UD Center for Political Communications' Paul Brewer, as well as Delaware Public Media political reporter Sarah Petrowich. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also delve into a University of Delaware study on the effectiveness of the shingles vaccine in preventing the disease, along with dementia and stroke. And Enlighten Me highlights a Veterans Day event that connects active service members with young readers. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The 2024 election nationally was a good one for Republicans, who returned Donald Trump to the White House and gained control of the U.S. Senate. But in Delaware, it was more of the same, with Democrats dominating statewide races and drawing another seat closer to a House supermajority. To dive into these storylines and more, we sat down this week with University of Delaware Communications Professor Paul Brewer, Delaware Politics Director at UD's Center for Political Communication, to get his analysis of the post-election state of play in the first state. Well, we'll start just kind of with your general impression at the national level of what we saw. And I think what most people considered a surprise, maybe not a surprise that Trump was able to win, but it seemed like a fairly decisive win, with him sweeping the major swing states that a lot of people felt, particularly the blue wall states, that Harris could take.
Yes. And so in a sense, it's surprising that he did a clean sweep of those seven toss-up states that we've been talking about for the past few months. In another sense, it's not terribly surprising. One, if you look at his performance relative to polls, he's kind of outperformed the polls three times in a row now, which makes me, not by a lot, but by a little, which makes me wonder if survey researchers need to continue to look at what they're doing there, look at their models.
I went up there for just a second because I'm curious, because we hear a lot about how those polling research folks were adjusting. They were constantly adjusting for Trump, and they still apparently didn't quite get it right. Is that maybe even more troubling, that not that they kept missing it, but they kept missing it even though they were trying not to miss it?
Yes, and we're talking about it looks like will be a fairly small polling error. So if Trump ends up winning by national popular vote by 2%, and I think that figure could change between now because they're still counting votes. Right. So it's going to be a fairly narrow popular vote win. So in a sense, if you look at it from a polling error, it's not a big polling error.
It's within the margin.
Yeah, it's within the margin. But still, you know, it's a more dramatic outcome than maybe some people were expecting. I see a lot of speculation, oh, we might not know for days, and we actually did know within a day. But to come back to that broader context, at first glance, it looks like there's this dramatic swing from 2016 to 2020 to 2024. And in terms of the outcome, it has been. But in terms of the kind of the percentage that's actually moving back and forth, it's pretty small. So flip a few percentage points one way or another, and it turns like a 300 electoral victory margin into in the low 200s range loss. We're in a pretty polarized state where the band of outcomes over the past few cycles has actually been pretty narrow.
And pretty static. It's just the impact is where it feels really dramatic. It's an interesting point. Let's talk a little bit more about it from the local level in the context of Delaware, this presidential race. Vice President Kamala Harris did win Delaware as expected, but her support here lagged a little bit behind what the UD Center for Political Communication poll of Delaware found in October. That poll had Harris with a 59-32% edge. She wound up winning the state 57-42. Does that show that even in a deeply blue Delaware, Trump support might again have been underestimated a little bit?
Yeah, I think if you look at the figures that I've seen so far, it's been a pretty national shift towards Trump compared to the 2020 outcome. So I think you see that in the national results, not a huge swing, but a big enough swing to flip all of those key toss-up states. In Delaware, not enough to change the outcome, but still noticeable.
So it also seemed like GOP candidates for governor and lieutenant governor slightly outperformed candidates in other statewide races. Both Mike Ramone in the governor's race, Ruth Briggs King in the lieutenant governor's race hit 44% and 45% mark, respectively. That's the best GOP showing in either of those races since Bill Lee hit 46% in his 51-46 loss to the late Ruth Ann Minner in 2004. I'm curious if you think that speaks to the strength of running a pair of better-known current and former state lawmakers with maybe higher credibility and track records, or could the GOP's messages of the dangers of one-party rule be gaining a little bit of traction, at least within some pockets of Delaware?
Yeah, I think there's probably multiple factors at play here. One is simply those national tides sweeping through Delaware as well. You know, if you look at polling, a pretty big percentage of the population thinks that the country is on the wrong track. So you're going to see that at all levels in terms of which party people side for. But I do think, compared to some past campaigns that I won't mention, that Ramone ran a more centrist, moderate, kind of professional campaign than we've seen in some statewide races. So I noticed that in the debate here at the University of Delaware, he was at pains to pitch himself as a yellow candidate instead of a red or a blue candidate. He name-checked not only Mike Castle, who's kind of the patron saint of moderate Delaware Republicans and one of the last statewide figures to have a lot of electoral success, but he also name-checked Chris Coons and John Carney and Tom Carper as people in a favorable light. And, you know, Ramone was a long-time state representative, and so just a credible candidate. So it's not terribly surprising to me, given the national political environment and his relative strengths as a candidate compared to some other past statewide Republican nominees, that he had, you know, not a strong enough showing to pull off an upset, but a stronger showing than some past candidates.
And I guess there is kind of an intersection between that kind of general dissatisfaction with maybe the state of the economy right now and pitching people, hey, one party rule, you know, that we've got here because one party rule. Maybe that does work a little bit better in this particular environment maybe than it did in past elections.
Yes, and you have to wonder if Ramone had had more resources, if he'd had, you know, a higher media profile, which is tough in Delaware. Nothing right. against Delaware public media, but if you wanted to run kind of a traditional television-based campaign, there are a lot of challenges in that, both in terms of the amount of money you'd need and then in terms of the what do you do with the Philadelphia and Baltimore media markets.
Sure.
Kind of a challenge for Ramone there, but again, a respectable performance compared to past Republican outcomes.
And certainly perhaps all these factors we're talking about helps the Republicans keep the Democrats from flipping the two seats they needed to get a supermajority in the state House of Representatives. Again, you know, there was a lot of thought if there was a blue wave, if there was, you know, a kind of trickle down from the presidential race on the Democratic side, that would lead to that House supermajority for Democrats. Instead, perhaps what we saw nationally kind of forestalled any Democratic gains. They flipped one seat, but not the two.
Yes, at the state level, in terms of the legislative races, very static picture. There's only no changes in the Senate, correct?
No changes in the
Senate. Only that one, which ironically, it was Ramone's seat, right?
Right, exactly. So, yeah, the one seat they lost was the one that he left to run for governor. So, yeah, it seems like, yeah, for the time being, at least, we're in a holding pattern with the state legislature. I am curious. One thing I found interesting in looking at the numbers statewide was that the top statewide vote getter was the winner in the insurance commissioner's race, incumbent Democrat Trinidad Navarro. He won with nearly 59% of the vote. Just over 289,000 people voted for him, only about 200 votes less than Kamala Harris got statewide in Delaware. How do you explain that race is that just a, you know, he's a reflection of what a straight ticket voter does. They don't know who to vote for in that race. So the majority of Delaware is going to vote for Democrats. So they just click generic D as opposed to generic GOP.
It's funny you mentioned that because I noticed how well Navarro did. I think partly that's it, because I think that position is not a very high-profile position, but I think that interacts with the other key factor here, which is Navarro's an incumbent.
There is some name recognition, like, hey, I voted for this guy before.
Yeah, I voted for this guy last time around. I know nothing about his opponent. So I'm
going
to check that
I'm just going to roll that way. It is. It's. I found that just an interesting anomaly in voting. That, you know, of all the people, you would not think that the insurance commissioner would be the one who kind of performed as well as the presidential candidate in the state.
And with that name recognition, maybe he's got a chance to move on up in the future.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, this is his third term. When we talked to him, we asked him about, you know, running again. He kind of left the door open to what he might do. So perhaps something to watch for in the coming years. Also curious what you make of Kent County, because heading into Tuesday, it was one of only 25 counties nationwide that went Obama, Obama, Trump, Biden. Now, it did not swing back to Trump, but it came awfully close, picking Harris by just about 1,800 votes. The margins there are very similar in other races. County, even went for one Republican. Ruth Briggs King won that county in the lieutenant governor's race. So I guess the question is Kent still kind of a bellwether county, or is this maybe an indication that since it didn't flip back to Trump, that it is slowly kind of becoming more blue in this state and the kind of Democratic influence is starting to creep into Kent County?
Yeah, well, I think one way to look at it is, even though the Republicans didn't win statewide, things did swing their way, but I think it also illustrates the challenge, even in a favorable national political environment, it's really tough for them to win. And, you know, in their strongholds, they don't have a lot of strongholds in Delaware, and it's tough to pile up big enough margins in those places to pull off a statewide victory unless something changes.
I want to quickly ask you a little bit about turnout in Delaware. 65%, that matched 2012 and 2016, but lagging behind the 68% in 2020. I suppose you could explain that through the fact that there was no mail-in voting this time around like there was during the pandemic in 2020, but could it also be an indication maybe of a little less enthusiasm this year? We've heard a lot about people just not being satisfied with the choices they had.
Yeah, I think both at the national level and the state level, that Democrats especially seemed hugely motivated in 2020, you know, as I think largely as a reaction against Donald Trump. This time around, maybe there's some of that motivation has waned, maybe some enthusiasm for their own party. You know, I think if Biden had been the nominee, that it might have been even rougher for the Democrats, because I think Harris managed to capture at least some enthusiasm. I've seen some polling results to suggest that if Biden had been the nominee, that the national outcome would not have been as close as it was.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic and an interesting what if. But I think you're right. I do think there is a sense that people were definitely dissatisfied when you told them the choice was Trump-Biden, maybe a little less dissatisfied, but still dissatisfied Trump-Harris. So, again, something that I think Democrats have to think about as they move forward, both in the state and nationwide. And I guess we'll wrap up just by asking, is there anything else that stood out to you in Delaware or nationally in the results that we saw and where things are heading?
Well, at the national level, where does this leave the Democrats? Mm. Because I think it's really going to be kind of a turning of the page. You know, no more Obamas or Obama's vice president or even Biden's vice president. Whoever leads the party in 2028 is probably someone who has not been on the national stage yet. There's names we could talk about there, but I think it's a couple days after, so a little early for that. at the level of Delaware, you have to ask the same question: what are Republicans going to try to do? Because they put up some solid-looking candidates who did respectably, and it still wasn't enough. They didn't gain any seats in the Senate. They lost a seat in the House. So what's the formula for being competitive statewide in Delaware for the Republican Party?
Particularly when you look at a congressional delegation now that is somewhat new and younger, and, you know, with a Sarah McBride in the House, Lisa Blunt-Rochester moving up to the Senate, Chris Coons, who I guess, relatively speaking, in the Senate, having only been there since 2010, is relatively young. These are Democrats who are likely going to be there for a little while in those offices and continue running for those offices as incumbents.
Yeah, and maybe more progressive competition as well. So, you know, I think Sarah McBride, not going to be a squad member, but maybe that's a trade towards a somewhat more progressive direction with her going into the congressional delegation and then Carper coming out, and then trading Carney for Meyer. I don't think Meyer campaigned under progressive banner, but he also doesn't seem allergic to the label progressive. And then they're going to be choosing a new speaker in the House as well. And so some of the power dynamics in terms of the more centrist wing of the Democratic Party and the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party, we could see maybe some changes there.
Thanks to University of Delaware Communications Professor Paul Brewer, Delaware Politics Director at UD's Center for Political Communication, for joining us on The Green this week. Next up, we delve a bit deeper into the fallout from Tuesday's election here in Delaware with Delaware Public Media political reporter Sarah Petrowich. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We continue our look at the fallout from Tuesday's general election here in Delaware with a closer look at how the results will impact the political landscape, especially in the General Assembly. There will be a new governor in Matt Meyer, along with a new Democratic House Speaker and a new Republican House Minority Leader. But Democrats failed to pick up the two seats they needed to grab a House supermajority to go with the one they have in the state Senate. To examine what all this means and what we might expect when lawmakers reconvene in January, Delaware Public Media political reporter Sarah Petrowich joined me earlier this week to discuss where things stand. So let's start with governor. As expected, Democrat Matt Meyer defeated Republican Mike Ramone. His 56-44% margin, similar to the margins that John Carney won by in the previous two gubernatorial races, suggesting perhaps that Meyer's bruising primary with Lieutenant Governor Bethany Hallwong did not really hurt him very much with voters. The question now is, what is his relationship going to be with legislators as the new governor? I want to play a couple of clips for you from his acceptance speech on Tuesday night and get your reaction to these.
As your governor, we can and will do so much more. We can all agree that for far too long there was a Delaware way that served insiders and ignored the talents and potential of so many who've been left behind.
And here's another one.
There are a lot of well-heeled people and insiders who can take care of themselves, and typically do. The people we need to be concerned about are the rest of us, Delawareans across this state in all three counties, in the cities, the suburbs, and the rural areas.
So what do you make of that, Sarah? Is there a suggestion there that Meyer is looking to really kind of shake things up?
Yeah, Meyer definitely seems like a more progressive candidate than Governor Carney and has campaigned largely on fixing Delaware's education system. You know, it's got an outdated funding formula, continues to produce low proficiency rates statewide. And he has been a proponent of trying to break up this so-called Delaware way, you know, this kind of network of insiders, and has definitely called himself and considers himself an outsider to that system. So during the primary, he seemed to have initial support only from progressive members of the legislature, but following the election, we now have a few more progressive legislators in the House and an opportunity for more in the Senate with some upcoming special elections. So I think Meyer is definitely going to try and capitalize on that new makeup of the legislature. And as you and I both know, as he said in interviews with us, he has something called, quote, Meyer time, which alludes to the idea that he wants to get policy done and get it done quickly. So, you know, and Governor Carney also seemed to have a largely reactive tenure, meaning he definitely had some policies that he championed, but he took sort of a backseat to when it came to what legislation Democrats wanted to push in the General Assembly. And I think Meyer has indicated that he would like a more reactive role in that process, and he's especially going to need to do that if he wants to change the education system and some of those other progressive policy points.
So how likely is an aggressive Meyer going to play well with lawmakers? You mentioned kind of there is a little bit of a change. There's maybe some more progressive lawmakers now that might be more open to that. But going back in time, when Jack Markell was in a similar position, surprisingly won a primary, then became governor, there was tension for a Markell who was more proactive like Meyer may be than reactive like Carney. And that it took a little while for them to kind of gain footing. How do you see this maybe kind of playing out? I mean, it certainly feels like with the backing that many legislators had for Paul Long in the primary, this could be something worth watching, at least in the first months, as everybody kind of gets their feet on the ground.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right that it'll be interesting to follow the relationship with Meyer and lawmakers. And it's definitely true that the majority of Democratic lawmakers who did formally endorse a candidate endorsed Ha Long. Mm-hmm. But I will say that as more information came to light about Ha Long's campaign finances, I think more legislators felt comfortable distancing themselves from her campaign. Although I still see plenty of professional respect for her and what she's done for the state. I will also give credit to Meyer that he did make a real effort to gain some key endorsements, especially those that initially backed Ha Long, like the Laborers International Union of North America and the state's largest union, the Delaware State Education Association. Mm-hmm. And he's also very quickly publicly merged his campaign message to advocate for an administration with the now Lieutenant Governor-elect Kyle Evans-Gay. So all of that is to say, yes, I think Meyer is a strong-headed leader, but he has clearly indicated some desire for compromise. And again, I think the more progressive legislature will be helpful for him. But if the current Democratic leadership team largely stays the same, there could be more pushback because that's a strong-willed team as well.
You mentioned the incoming Lieutenant Governor Kyle Evans-Gay. Is this where she could play a role? That, you know, she's been in the state Senate. Maybe she's the bridge between a Meyer administration and the General Assembly.
Yeah, Kyle Evans-Gay, you know, definitely also has progressive policy points. She's been a champion for early childhood education and women's reproductive rights in Delaware. So I think their platforms seem to mesh well. And she does have an edge as someone who served in the state Senate for 4 years. So I think 100% it would benefit Meyer to lean on her to understand the politics of the legislature. She will also now preside over the Senate, so she gets a more active role in the General Assembly as a member of the executive branch. So the lieutenant governor's position is kind of whatever the holder wants it to be. Mm. So, you know, only time will tell, I think, what Evans-Gay makes of that role and if she can bridge that gap between Meyer and the legislature. But I think it would definitely be beneficial for him to lean on her, and especially with that experience that she has.
And as you noted, he kind of was making it clear that he wanted to do that. Even in his acceptance speech, he even said pretty forcefully, like, my lieutenant governor, Kyle Evans-Gay. So I think he was trying to kind of be like, yes, we are a team and we're going to work together. And maybe that's helpful.
Absolutely. I mean, even right after the primary election, there was a form the next day and he was immediately calling her, you know, my lieutenant governor, and we're going to do this together. So he definitely made that transition quickly and kind of has that willpower, I think, to bridge that gap.
So the other big story on election night was Democrats' efforts to secure a supermajority in the House of Representatives. Can you walk us through how that played out and what that might mean for what's happening going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. It was pretty interesting. There was a couple of races we were looking at. There were definitely four key races where we, you know, thought the Democrats could gain at least a two-thirds majority, which would be a supermajority. And two-thirds is needed in order to pass the first leg of constitutional amendments, which is essentially the first version of a constitutional amendment. But they would have needed to keep that supermajority to pass a second leg following the 2026 election. So, you know, they wouldn't have completely unyielding power, but it would have been a start to get some things passed, like constitutionalizing abortion rights, constitutionalizing some of those voting rights we've seen, like mail-in voting, permanent absentee, and early voting. Although Republicans have largely shown support for early voting, but not as much on the other two. Democrats did gain a 3/5 majority in the House, though, which is needed to enact increases in taxes and licensing fees, so they wouldn't need Republican support to pass legislation like that. And they can also override a governor veto without Republican support, although we don't necessarily see that being a problem, but you never know. We've seen it in the past. So, but yeah, so those key races, I mean, Mike Smith, he's a Republican. He kept his Newark seat with 55% of the vote. Brian Shoup kept his Milford seat with 63% of the vote. And then Kevin Hensley kept his seat with 53% of the vote. So the only seat that Democrats gained was Mike Ramone's open seat in Pike Creek South, which Working Families Party endorsed candidate Frank Burns won with 58% of the vote.
And Burns had been so close previously to knocking off Ramone. It seemed like he finally got his opportunity with Ramone out. We also looked at a couple of other races that we thought might perhaps be in play, and it turned out really none of them. You know, Monica Beer was not able to make any inroads. Terrell Williams did better in his second run against Hensley, but it seemed like, you know, for all intents and purposes, it was kind of a very static election, except for that one race that did give them kind of, I called it the other night, a kind of a mini supermajority, right? That they could do some stuff without the GOP, but they don't have that full supermajority power. Before next session begins, lawmakers have some other things to work out before we start talking about what legislation is going to be passed or not. And that starts with leadership. And obviously, we know in the House there's two leadership positions, one GOP, one Democratic, that are open. What needs to get done here, and how might that shape what happens going forward?
Yeah, exactly like you said. So both chambers do need to elect new leadership at the beginning of every new General Assembly. All the current Senate leadership that was up for re-election maintained their seats, and that's expected to stay the same, so we probably won't see a shakeup there. But as you said, House leadership, on the other hand, will 100% see a little bit of a shakeup. So in a huge upset, progressive candidate Kamala Smith beat Speaker of the House Valerie Longhurst for her Bear Area seat in the primary, and she's also won her general. And Mike Ramone vacates his seat as a Republican leader of the House following his run in the governor's race. So the natural progression would be that House Majority Leader Melissa Minor Brown is elected Speaker, and then Carrie Evelyn Harris, who is the Majority Whip, becomes the Majority Leader, and then elect a new Majority Whip. And then the same progression on the Republican side would be Lyndon Yurick, Minority Leader, would become the
Minority Whip.
Minority Whip, thank you. Would become the Minority Leader, absolutely. And then the Republicans would elect someone new for Minority Whip. So, you know, anything can happen. Those are the natural progressions, but those are all open elections, you know, and multiple legislators can run for those positions.
It could be very interesting because I know there are some people who had looked at perhaps someone like a Brian Shoup, who it seems to, you know, do a good job reaching across the aisle. Could be someone who could be up for a leadership role. And then there was like, oh, well, he barely won his primary. And then he wins in a landslide. I mean, is he the type of person who might be on the Republican side, someone who could step into leadership, maybe not as the leader, but as the whip following Lyndon Yurick?
Absolutely. I think Shoup is definitely a favorite. And even with some of the voters that I was talking to in the Milford area on the general election, there were several Democrats who said that, you know, they've always supported Shoup. They think he's done a good job. You know, they said that they voted Democrat for the rest of the ticket, but Shoup was the outlier. So he definitely has some great name recognition. And you're right, I've definitely seen him in the legislature working across the aisle. And Mike Smith is another one who retained his seat, mm-hmm. and he's also great at working across the aisle and could definitely be someone who's up for that spot.
And certainly on the Democratic side, it'll be interesting to see what, if any, leverage perhaps those progressive legislators from the Working Families Party have in terms of deciding whether they do any change in leadership or perhaps filling that one spot if they do move everybody up and open up that whip seat.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, that natural progression will be interesting to see if Melissa Minor Brown becomes a speaker. And, you know, we've kind of got what we have there already. But you're right, the whip seat is open. And if a progressive candidate gets in there, then they could be setting themselves up, you know, to eventually become Speaker of the House. So the next couple of years will definitely be key in seeing how the Democratic Party shapes up in the legislature.
So the other thing we have to talk about is two special elections that are looming to fill seats vacated by state senators. Now Congresswoman-elect Sarah McBride and State Senator, now Lieutenant Governor-elect Kyle Evans-Gay. First, can you explain to us how those seats will be filled? What's the special election process?
Yeah, absolutely. So the nitty-gritty, within 10 days of the vacancy, a writ of election needs to be sent to the Department of Elections, directing the department to conduct a special election for those vacated seats. And then that writ specifies the date on which the election will be held, which must be no earlier than 30 days and no more than 35 days from the day after the writ was issued.
And both those seats appear to be safe Democratic seats, correct?
Yeah. Sarah McBride's seat is in Senate District 1 in the Wilmington area, and Evans-Gay's seat is District 5, which is the Tallyville area. McBride's seat has been a longtime blue seat, but Evans-Gay's seat was previously held by a Republican before the 2020 election, so there's always the possibility of a flip, but they seem pretty safe.
Yeah, special elections can be weird. You see a lot of times really low turnout. If you're someone who can really have a good ground game, maybe you could pull an upset if you're a Republican. But as you said, likely safe Democratic seats. Anything else stand out to you, Sarah, about these election results and the impact we might see going into next year?
Yeah, I mean, I think we just have a lot of ongoing questions as far as legislation goes. I mean, I think that the makeup is still strong and there's a lot of, you know, Democratic pushed issues that are going to continue into the next session. But I mean, we also have a lot of Democratic backed things like the Hospital Cost Review Board that was passed, you know, offshore wind projects. Those are both facing lawsuits right now. We've got the Public Education Funding Commission that's going to be ongoing to restructure that funding system for Delaware's public education, climate stuff, budget deficits. I mean, there's so many questions to be held. I mean, we're keeping the same makeup in our General Assembly, which is that Democratic majority and the Republican minority. But it'll be interesting to see how those compromises play out going forward.
Thanks to Delaware Public Media political reporter Sarah Petrowich for joining us on The Green this week. Next up, we head to the University of Delaware to learn more about a study on the effectiveness of the shingles vaccine in preventing the disease, as well as dementia and stroke. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. About a third of Americans will develop shingles, a painful rash from the same virus that causes chickenpox. and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends anyone over 50 get the shingles vaccine. At the University of Delaware, a $1.7 million study is underway, allowing Assistant Professor of Epidemiology Daniel Harris to access the health records for roughly 3 million nursing home residents to take a closer look at the effectiveness of the shingles vaccine in preventing the disease, as well as dementia and stroke. And Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny caught up with Harris this week to learn more about the study and the efficacy of the shingles vaccine.
So first of all, what is shingles and who's most at risk?
So shingles is a virus. It's a disease that comes from a reactivation of the shingles virus. Folks who were exposed to the chickenpox as a kid, they have this virus inside of them. And then as we get older, changes in our immune system can cause this virus to re-express itself in the form of shingles. And shingles is a very painful disease that can present in various parts of the body, including the face and the trunk. And it has a number of complications, including being very painful. Older adults are generally seen at greater risk of this due to those immunological changes that we observe with aging.
Now, there is a vaccine for shingles. It's called Shingrix. How does it work?
There's been a vaccine for shingles now for several decades. The first vaccine was called Zostavax, and it came out in the mid-early 2000s, and it was a live vaccine. It was a single dose. This vaccine wasn't as effective. It wasn't very effective. So then the Shingrix vaccine came out in 2017, and this is a two-dose recombinant vaccine. It's a bit of a different type of vaccine, and it's much more effective than Zostavax. So evidence from the trials show that, you know, upwards of 90% of folks show a reduction in shingles risk if they receive the two-dose series. So basically, it just helps to train our immune system to help combat that shingles reactivation.
And there's a connection between shingles and stroke and dementia. Can you kind of lay that out for us?
That's right. Yeah. So a lot of viral infections or infections generally, right, are kind of, they cause this acute disease. So if I have shingles reactivation, I get shingles. I get the rash on my body or on my trunk. But these sorts of viruses can cause a host of other downstream negative health outcomes. So shingles, for example, is known to increase the risk of stroke. More severe cases of shingles, right, can cause challenges with their eyes. So basically, it's this inflammation. And this increase in inflammation is associated with a number of bad health outcomes. Now, regarding dementia, due to this neuroinflammation that's caused by shingles, because the shingles virus likes to express itself through nerve lines, there are a number of pathways that you can get from a shingles infection and shingles reactivation kind of through to stroke, through to increased dementia. Because we know if someone has a stroke and they sustain some sort of brain damage through a stroke, that this can increase your risk of a very particular type of dementia called vascular dementia, but various other dementias as well. So there's a kind of complex clinical pathway where you can get from shingles through to these various other neurological changes and inflammation downstream to other kind of cognitive and kind of dementia-like effects as well. But that's at least what we hypothesize.
So tell me a little bit about what you're going to be studying, what you're working on.
So there have been a number of observational studies that have found an association between shingles vaccination and a reduced risk of dementia. These studies have a number of methodological weaknesses, though. So one of the key goals of this research is to improve upon those weaknesses and to try to provide kind of more robust evidence of whether there is this association between shingles vaccination and dementia risk. And we're going to do this through a series of studies that try to understand those causal mechanisms and those causal pathways from vaccination through to these kind of to reactivation of shingles itself, to stroke and other sorts of clinical outcomes that may result in a change in dementia risk.
Can you talk a little bit about the scope of the study? One thing that really stood out to me, you're working with a ton of data here.
So that's one of the other, yeah. So you know, that's a key strength, and we have a number of partners in the research here. So, you know, we work with folks who have access to nursing home electronic health record data, and this gives us a lot more statistical power to identify potentially small associations. You need a lot of people to kind of maybe show small effects. But we're also working with folks in the VA system, and they have wonderful access to data there. as you mentioned, it's like these are very large databases. So we're going to try to pool them together to make to improve the statistical efficiency even more, to try to get some better evidence and more conclusive evidence as to the link between shingles vaccination and dementia.
And you touched on this a little bit. There's a parallel study as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So the way that we kind of describe this study is that there are two arms. We have one arm that takes place in a community nursing home setting, and these are folks who go to your nursing home down the street. But then we also have folks in the VA system. So we're running both of these studies in parallel. And in epidemiologic parlance, they're called target trials, where we basically use health administrative data that's collected in nursing homes, and we try to emulate what a trial would look like if we were to, randomize someone to receive the shingles vaccine or not. We try to emulate this sort of trial using real-world data. And we're doing this sort of emulation in the community setting, but as well in the VA setting. And the goal is then to see, do we get similar answers in these two populations? If not, why not? And if we do get similar answers, can we pool them together to help kind of increase the statistical efficiency and precision of those associations?
Your study is looking at records from over 3 million individuals, millions more coming from the VA side. Can you kind of pull back the curtain on how those numbers get crunched? I'm picturing the world's most complicated Excel spreadsheet right now.
Yeah, so we don't use Excel. That's the first key. And yeah, so managing these big databases requires a particular sort of skill set and expertise, and it requires a lot of computational power. So we use statistical software to help manage and manipulate these large databases, and then essentially run statistical models that help us to understand the associations between vaccination and our outcomes of interest. In this case, it's things like shingles infection, stroke, and dementia. So it requires quite a bit of computational power to do these things.
How long do you estimate your research is going to take?
Oh, I think it'll probably take, we just are kicking things off. So certainly we're going to be chugging away at this for the next year plus or so, and it'll probably go into year two, I can imagine, before we have any kind of idea of how things are looking, just because of how big these data sources are.
Do you have any expectations for what this data is going to yield?
I really don't, actually. I think one of the reasons why I don't is because there has been such limited work in this particular population. So in the nursing home population, this is a population that I care quite a bit about, and a lot of my research is among long-term care residents, and we just simply don't. We haven't done enough work in this group of people to understand how this vaccine works, and because they're quite distinct clinically and socially. So I really don't have any expectations at this time. I think that, we hope to start presenting findings at conferences in the next couple of, months or so, and hopefully then we'll have a better idea of what we're coming up in the data, but we're still at a very early stage.
Thanks to UD Assistant Professor of Epidemiology Daniel Harris and R. Martin Matheny for taking time to join us on The Green this week. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me, where we learn about a Veterans Day storytime event that connects active service members with young readers. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us all on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. On Veterans Day, more than 20,000 students in all 50 states will be treated to video stories read aloud by active duty service members. The Storytime with a Service Member event, held by the nonprofit United Through Reading, gives young students a chance to connect with service members and highlights how crucial it is to keep our youth reading, a growing challenge in today's digital age when children have multiple distractions at their fingertips. In this edition of Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Kyle McKinnon speaks with Melanie Sheridan, Director of Marketing and Communications for United Through Reading, about story time with a service member and teaching a child to love the act of reading.
All right, Melanie, you are indeed a military spouse and mom, so I'd say you're the foremost authority today. Let's start with some background, though, on story time with a service member. What was the reasoning behind starting it, and how long has this been going on?
This is our third year doing this, and we really wanted to try to bridge some of the gap between the military and the civilian world, particularly when it comes to the classroom. We wanted to be able to, you know, bring a uniformed, or in some cases when we have veterans who are doing this, non-uniformed service members into classrooms as a way to kind of maybe help some of the civilian kids understand a little bit about what their military counterparts might be going through. You know, we understand that, you know, when someone signs up to serve in the military, it's the whole family that serves. You know, kids serve too is one of our phrases. And, you know, so sometimes, you know, the adults in the room, so to speak, the teachers, administrators, they understand that when their military kids might be sad or angry or possibly, you know, acting out in the classroom, it may have to do with a deployment or, you know, some type of home situation where their military family member, dad, whoever is away, and it's causing that stress. And so we wanted to help some of the kids in the classroom understand that what this lifestyle is like, because if you're not in the lifestyle, you don't really get it. So we want to try to help these other kids get it to the best of our ability. And bringing in a service member, having them talk about, hey, this is, you know, who I am. Nice to meet you. This is what I do in the military. And maybe that will help garner a little bit of empathy and understanding between the military and the civilian community of those kids.
Yeah. And can you speak a little more to some of what you just had to say as far as the duality here goes in the value of service members connecting with kids and essentially teaching young readers to love reading in their own way? Can you speak to the importance in our modern world of both of those things and why they pair so well together?
You know, I think especially for younger kids who are participating, you know, the kindergartners, the elementary school kids, you hear service member and it's a very broad term. You know, the military is a big term, and we wanted to help humanize it. We wanted to help put some faces behind those uniforms. Sometimes some of the kids, it's like, hey, that's my family member is the one who gets to record the video that they all watch. So humanizing the people behind the uniforms and having those kids understand that these are the people in your community, you know, who are the people in your neighborhood. And that as far as just story time is such a powerful word. You know, it's like you can think about when you were a child and what it meant to have someone read you a story and the emotions and the feelings behind that. So, you know, one of the things that we do at United Through Reading is that we want to keep people connected, particularly the military family, connected using story time. And then to your point about the academics, there's a whole lot of research about how being read to helps with literacy and learning and not having kids just try to decipher on their own. There's a whole lot of synapses and things that are happening in your brain when you're learning to read, you know, the process of learning to read, that this is a letter. Letters make sounds. Sounds make words. Words make sentences. And all of these things are happening while they're learning to read. And so for kids who are possibly struggling with that process, having somebody read to them and being able to follow along with the book, it can help those synapses even better. It's like, I may not recognize that word. I've heard that word. And then they can, again, piece, when I see these letters in this combination, that's what that word is. And so just the magic of all the things that can happen in kids' brains when they're being read to is just phenomenal. So knowing that we're able to provide, you know, again, for the military community, these videos of their family members reading to them, and we send the book home. You know, that's one of the benefits of our service is that anybody who makes a recording, we will also send the book home, and it's free of charge for them, for the military family. And then again, for the schools, for Jim just to have a peek inside what it's like to be a military family.
So in terms, you mentioned the books, in terms of how this works, how do you figure out what books are fitting and might, you know, spark that curiosity or that interest from young readers? Is that something United Through Reading decides, or is it the service members that decide on, you know, the book that's going to be read, or is that, you know, a collaborative process?
It's kind of collaborative, because what we want to make sure is that these classrooms have the playlist that we're going to send out will have, you know, roughly 15 to possibly 20 videos in it, and we break them down by age group. That way, each of the teachers, you know, they get this list. It's going to be an unlisted YouTube link. They'll be able to sort through and say, I've got a classroom of kids, you know, in this X range. This story would be most appropriate for them. So we want to give them, you know, a broad range so that they can pick what fits best in with what they're learning, you know, at the moment and where they are in the kids' reading skills. And, you know, for the older kids, you know, we're not going to read, you know, like a board book, you know, to the older kids. So we want it broken up by age. And then we're also really trying to bring a little bit of a multicultural element to that. So as of now, I believe we have one story in Spanish that's been recorded in Spanish, and we also have one story that's in American Sign Language. So again, it's a way for maybe some of these kids have never seen American Sign Language before. And if that sparks their interest in anything, if that gets them, you know, talking about that, what is, you know, American Sign Language? I want to learn American Sign Language. And then again, if they have a deaf or hard of hearing member in their classroom, just another connection piece and another touch point.
Yeah. Well, story time with a service member begins on Veterans Day and goes throughout the entire week. What kind of feedback have you received through these recent years? You know, is there anything that sticks out, I guess, in your mind, whether it's from service members, you know, teachers, parents, or kids themselves, whoever that have participated in this? You know, what have you heard?
Teachers, you know, have, it's been overwhelmingly positive. They said this was such a unique offering to be able to, you know, some of them have not really told the kids what it's going to be about. You know, we're talking about Veterans Day and we're going to watch a story. And then, wow, up on the screen pops, you know, the service member. So it's just, again, it's that personal connection. You know, the kids love it. And then I think one of the sweetest ones was a teacher who told us they also incorporated our videos with writing cards to service members. So they did it as a whole classroom project and they found, you know, a unit that they could send some cards to. So again, just knowing that we're helping kids understand what it means to serve and maybe help see each other differently. And again, bring some empathy into the classroom.
Yeah, what a distinct experience it must be. Very formative. Outside of the classroom then, you know, Melanie, as a mom yourself, I think a lot of parents specifically put a lot of pressure on themselves to help their kids become good readers and you know, good readers that actually enjoy reading. So what advice, again, as a mom yourself, you know, do you have or might you have for parents that, you know, if they want to raise a reader, you know, how can they create an environment that is conducive or promotes a love of reading?
Well, there's research that says that just the mere presence of books in the home will increase a spark, you know, that interest in reading and then the reading competency. So I think it was, you know, having anywhere as few as like 20 books in a house can alter kids' perceptions. But there's also making it a habit. So making it a family affair. And I understand, you know, there's a lot of adults who necessarily don't love to read for pleasure, but it's, you know, when your kids see you picking up something, and that could be a newspaper, a magazine, modeling the behavior that you want to see is always fantastic. But then if there's parents who don't necessarily love reading, that's where audiobooks come in. You know, we are really big proponents of however kids want to read, let them read. You know, there's a lot of concern about screen time and, you know, things like that. And we totally get that. But if, you know, something is on a Kindle format and that's the only way your kids will read it, don't discourage that. Graphic novels are still books. Audio books are still books. So there's ways to incorporate reading and having that become a habit within a family that don't have to be a heavy lift, you know, on the parents per se. And a lot of that technology, I know it's come so far with, I mentioned earlier, reluctant readers or struggling readers. There's ways that kids, you know, maybe if they have dyslexia, and there's tools out there that can help them enjoy reading despite whether they may have some difficulty doing it. So, you know, modeling that behavior, having books in the home, making, you know, reading and showing them that reading is formulative, like good readers make good writers, good readers make good critical thinkers. So it's not just about the, you're not just sitting here reading a book and turning the pages. Again, you're altering your brain and you're making those synapses fire in such ways that it really affects those other areas of their life. You know, if they love science, well, then you need to be able to critically think about the data, you know, that you're going to absorb as a scientist. So reading is, it's really foundational.
And so let's say there's a parent or maybe better yet, a teacher out there who wants to see story time with a service member at their school. What should they do if they're interested in learning more about it and potentially bringing it to a classroom or a school area? How does that work?
Any teacher who wants to get involved with story time with a service member can go to our website, unitedthroughreading.org. You can use the little search bar and do Veterans Day, and we've got a link there. There's a form that's embedded on our website that they fill up. or that they fill in, they'll sign up, they'll get a confirmation email from us. We're going to send out those stories ahead of Veterans Day because we know that the timing with it being on, you know, the Monday, some teachers might be doing things ahead of Veterans Day, some might be doing the week after. So we want to make sure that they have those stories in time to incorporate them in their lessons plans. And that link will be available all week long for them, again, to watch one story. They can watch all the stories that are in their age group. We don't care. Watch as many as you want. Watch as many times as you want. We're here, you know, to provide this service for classrooms around the country and even around the world. From my understanding, we have Germany and Italy classrooms. We have two signed up there.
Thanks to Melody Sheridan, Director of Marketing and Communications for the nonprofit United Through Reading, and our Kyle McKinnon for enlightening us this week. And with that, we close the book on another edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking Newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny and Sarah Petrovich, along with our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernting. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into A First State of Mind.